Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, Michelle Evans, the chief of the aeronautics business at Lockheed Martin, joins us to discuss the company's portfolio and more. But first, retired United States Air Force Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, the dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies that is part of the Air Force Association, to discuss some key takeaways from the very first day of the Air Force Association's annual Airspace Cyber Conference and Trade Show that is happening for the first time in its history virtually. Dave, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Vago. It's great to be on, and I appreciate you taking a couple of minutes to chat with me.
It's always a pleasure, Dave, especially during AFA events. You were kind enough to join us repeatedly when we were down in Orlando for the last time that many of us saw each other one-on-one in a while. Obviously, this is a first and a tremendous first day. You guys have a little anchor team with Tobias Nagle, the editor of Air Force Magazine, as well as Amy McCullough, who's on the team there. Tobias doing a great interview with the chief after his comments. Let's start with some of the messages that we heard from senior leaders. Air Force Secretary Barrett did a great job kicking the conference off. And then we heard some really, really great comments from CQ Brown, the 22nd Chief of the United States Air Force, with his accelerate change or lose message, which is music to many people's ears, including my own. Talk to me about your sense on, let's start with Secretary Barrett first, what you heard from her that you thought was particularly noteworthy today.
Well, Vago, first, I'd like to reinforce your remarks. This is the first time the Air Force Association has done this virtually. We were really looking forward to having another session, as we always do, because of the virtues of networking in person. But I think the team that put this together did an excellent job, and it gives an opportunity for folks in this challenging environment to hear what the Secretary and the Chief of Staff and others have to say. Now, I would tell you that from my perspective, I think Secretary Barrett did a great job today explaining and reinforcing the Department of the Air Force's strategic priorities. And it's a good time to do that. In a nutshell, the four key priorities are: number one, building the Space Force; number two, strengthening partnership with our allies with a nod to the Air Force's new Arctic strategy; number three, growing strong leaders and resilient families, which is a very, very important part. And then number four, accelerating modernization of the Air and Space Force, which kind of dovetails on the Chief's theme of accelerating change. Now, Secretary Barrett, I think, also made some news by announcing a new weapons systems designator for the Department of the Air Force, the E series, that's in the letter E. This designator introduces the concept of digital engineering that will include not just aircraft, but weapons and satellites, which will be digitally engineered and virtually tested before ever taking physical form. And the example that she used was the new ET-7. Which is the first aircraft that really did go through thousands of hours of digital engineering before it was built.
Talk to us a little bit about what you found so interesting about what Chief Brown had to say.
Following Secretary Barrett, our new chief, General Brown, spoke, and he outlined a really simple, but it's important that his ABCD operations order outline established an easy to understand taxonomy of his focus areas. And I thought it was clever the way he did that. A for airmen, B for bureaucracy, C for competition, and D for design implementation. And inside this, he also talked about some of the things that he's going to take action on in the near term. And one of those is a force presentation and force sizing model for the Air Force, which, and you've heard me speak of this for decades now, is long overdue. And it's really welcome music to my ears to hear him state that this should be complete and announced by the end of the year.
I thought, you know, in terms of that, the message was so profound that, you know, he's talking about accelerate change or lose, empower airmen to the lowest level, give people rough guardrails, you know, beg forgiveness instead of request permission, you know, inform your superiors. If you don't hear from them, have a predisposition to execute. I mean, a lot of this stuff, folks would say, is long overdue. And one of the cases that he makes is our adversaries aren't standing still. And unless we have extreme urgency with how we respond, we're going to be in deep trouble. I love his soccer analogy. You know, when you take your kids, they're playing soccer, you show up at the wrong field at the wrong time. We want to make sure we're at the right field at the right time with the right capabilities instead of not.
The other point that I think it's important that he emphasized was you can't be innovative and risk averse at the same time. In terms of the kinds of perspectives he's going to introduce and encourage, he said, we need to have the after meeting in the meeting. And he goes, the reason that we've had these problems is that folks are simply afraid of getting in trouble. Now, I would tell you, and, you know, I've gotten to that point in my age where I can speak candidly. I don't have to worry about them taking me out of a flying assignment and sending me to the Pentagon. They did that six times while I was on active duty. They can't do it to me anymore. But that paradigm was introduced by Secretary Gates when he fired both the military and civilian leaders of the Air Force simultaneously. Never done in history before. And that sent a message that if one does speak truth to power, and power doesn't like it, then you'll be terminated. Secretary Gates' action set innovation and initiative back a generation. And it's great to see that the new chief is acting to reverse that mistake. The new chief's message is that one, the threat is real, urgent, and we have to move and move fast to meet our nation's security challenges. Two, it means changing fast and taking risk to do it. And like you said, that means delegating authority, not just talking about it. And three, this is about leadership. Grab it and apply it. It's well past time to move beyond the mother may I ask before acting model that's characterized the past decade plus. So, bottom line, Vago, I'm very optimistic about the message and the tone of the message the new chief has established about his focus areas and his operating perspective.
You know, one of the things also worth mentioning, you know, you suddenly realize that you've, you know, how long you've known somebody. And the chief mentioned how formative it was when he was, as a young captain, an aide to Ron Fogelman, one of the Air Force's great chiefs of staff. And I used to remember the message that General Fogelman used to drive forward. It's about leadership, not about management. At the end of the day. And I remember I was at Air Force Times at the time when somebody asked him about managing airmen, and he pounded the table with his hands and he said, I'm growing leaders, not managers. You know, it's clear that that legacy lives on. Dave, want to have you back on again for continued analysis. Thanks so very, very much. And I commend everybody to tune in and to check out some of the on-demand features, as well as a couple of the conversations that you guys will be having on a live basis tomorrow. Thanks so very much.
Have a great aerospace power kind of day.
Thanks very much, Dave.
All right.
And it's my honor to welcome Michelle Evans, the Executive Vice President of Lockheed Martin's aeronautics sector, the world's leading combat aircraft maker.
Great to talk to you again, and I'm sorry we didn't have an opportunity to talk at Farnborough.
Well, it is disappointing with what COVID's done, but Vago, it's great to have this time with you this afternoon. Thank you.
a real pleasure. And you mentioned COVID. Obviously, it's changed everything. It's affected people's lives, not just economically, but unfortunately for the hundreds of thousands of people around the world that have lost their lives. It's changed how virtually every company works. You guys have transitioned to effectively 4-day weeks, along with the rest of the defense industry, but also a whole bunch of measures, whether it's temperature checks and frequent tests of workforce, changing production lines. Talk to us a little bit about how the pandemic is permanently changing how you guys will be operating in the future, not just in a future crisis, but on a steady state behavior. As we've heard, even Navy acquisition executive Hondo Gertz has said, hey, look, this is an opportunity for us to really improve the game in a substantive fashion. How is this improving your game across the aeronautics enterprise?
So I'm really proud of the Lockheed Martin team. And to be honest, the entire, I would say, Lockheed supply chain team. You know, it has certainly been a challenge. As you mentioned, you know, we're putting in all the proper COVID preventative measures. Our employees have been great partners in terms of partnering with us, you know, taking their temperatures, making sure that, you know, we're mitigating the risks at every possible turn. And we're seeing that same partnership down our supply chain. It really has, as Hondo Gertz has said, been an opportunity for us to kind of rethink the way we do work. I know we'll talk a little bit later about, you know, as we transition to more of a digital engineering environment, that also complements as we think about work going virtual, being able to work across different boundaries than what we've traditionally done, not only within our aeronautics team, but across the company and with our supply chain. So again, I do see COVID as it's been very difficult, certainly feel for those that have lost family members. But I'm really proud of the Lockheed Martin and our supply chain partners who really stepped up. You know, we overcame a lot of challenges to continue to deliver critical capability to our customers. And again, we're going to take advantage of this to make sure we do do work smarter going forward, and really take the opportunity, as well as, you know, technology moves on and how to leverage technology. And I think the COVID has allowed us to really take advantage of technology greater than we would have had it not happened.
Let me ask you about the F-35, and obviously a global program, very, very important supply chains. COVID affected everybody everywhere, not just in the United States, but obviously was devastating in Italy and including in the United Kingdom, two critical partners. Talk to us about where we are about getting back on track, back on schedule, and how much it's going to cost at a time when there is some debate about reimbursement in the next stimulus package. I mean, obviously, this kind of falls in act of God category and is a perfectly allowable expenses associated with making up sort of the added investment there. So bring us up to speed on all elements of this critical program.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, it did impact the F-35 program. You know, we were gated by some of our suppliers who really, as you mentioned, had been hit hard by the COVID-19 pandemic. We did have to take the Lockheed Martin team to a rotating schedule. I think you probably read as we released that we went to a rotating schedule, so employees would work 2 weeks and then have 1 week off. And I'm really pleased that 2 weeks ago we brought the full team back on board. So we're back at full scale. The suppliers are back. We do have some suppliers that, you know, we're still working through the impact of COVID, but we're back to full force. We are going to be down somewhere between 15 to 20 jets this year in terms of our delivery commitments, but we're working with our suppliers and we're focused on getting those jets recovered over the next 2 years to get back to that full contract commitment of our F-35 program. So again, together with our suppliers, you're right, there is a cost impact. We're still working that. As you've read, you know, working to try and collect the cost with our supply chain as well as our own cost and really be able to negotiate that in an efficient manner with the government. So I know Ellen Lord is looking at ways where we can negotiate at a company level or at least at a major program level. So we're hopeful that you know, we'll be able to work through that with our customers and make sure that we get beyond this and get back to full-scale production.
One of the concerns people in the Pentagon have had is that, you know, given that this is a conjoined commercial defense industrial base, it is a national and aerospace industrial base.
The commercial aviation guys are hurting very, very badly all across the supply chain, whether you're looking at engine manufacturers, devastating impacts on Rolls, but just absolutely across the supply chain. And you rely on some of these guys who depend on a robust commercial business in order to be able to have those resources on the defense side. You know, we've talked to folks at General Electric and a number of other companies. Are you confident that these supply chains are going to remain intact, even as some of these companies, including some small ones, are coming under extraordinary and potentially lasting pressure on the commercial side of the business that could be an unanticipated impact on the defense side? And how do you mitigate that?
So we have maintained very tight integration with our suppliers. You know, we have over 5,000 suppliers that we have stayed tightly integrated on a weekly basis. And to be honest, for many of those companies that you mentioned have the mix of commercial and defense, they've really been able to focus on defense. So it's actually been a positive for defense that as they dealt with COVID, they've had the bandwidth because of the downturn of commercial to really help recover on the defense side quickly. So as we've worked through the supply chain, while we've had suppliers that are struggle, the suppliers are all in, they're coming back online, and most of them are back to full strength. So we actually have you know, while it's, you know, a tough on those companies from the commercial side, it actually has allowed them to really step up and recover on the defense side from COVID quickly.
Let me ask you a broader F-35 question. The program has really been delivering. It's been hitting its stride. As we discussed, COVID-19 has dealt a bit of a setback, and the whole plan is to sort of buy back those airplanes downstream. But we're now in a period of significant national debt. Trillions of dollars have gone to the stimulus packages so far. There's more expected. The Fed has done a lot of work. And there is a recognition that we, you know, even though the airplane has great attributes, that we may need future platforms, NGAD in the Air Force side, FXX on the Navy side for these new generation air dominance aircraft. And then there's a whole myriad of longer range unmanned strike programs. Some of those obviously are highly classified. What's the right way to make this transition? Because folks are talking about the need for fewer F-35s, maybe we stretch out production, we reduce the rate on them. But then again, volume is what allows you to get that really, really nice price point that you guys are shooting at. You're trying to get below $70 million a unit that will then in turn drive sales. How do you perceive this debate and the elements of it and how to mitigate the impacts on the F-35 program at the end of the day?
So I'll start off with affordability. You know, you talked about, you know, the national debt. We recognize that. We recognize the defense budgets and the need to be really focused on affordability. So as you mentioned, you know, we've delivered 550 aircraft, and we did achieve the $80 million jet that many thought was not achievable. And we were able to achieve that, in fact, 1 year sooner than was planned. So we aren't going to stop. We're going to continue to drive the recurring cost of the jet down. If you look at comparable platforms for a full up platform, an $80 million jet is pretty competitive. So we're going to continue to drive that price down. And that includes as we upgrade the jet. So as we look at, you know, upgrading to TR-3 and Block 4 and really continuing to advance the capabilities, how do we continue to keep the cost equal to or less and continue to drive that down? Also on the sustainment side, we're very focused on affordability. As you've heard us talk about, our commitment to get to $25,000 per flight hour by 2025. And again, that commitment is to get it to equal or less than fourth gen aircraft in terms of sustainment cost. And the same with modernization. You know, we've talked a lot. You've heard F-35 with the C2D2 concept in terms of how do we get into this continuous upgrade? Lockheed Martin is very committed to that so that we can continue to pace the threat. You talked about kind of, I'll say, next gen capabilities. We actually view it as complementary. I think to your point, you know, we do need quantities to be able to really pace the threat and be able to maintain our competitive posture in the U.S. So we actually view many of the, I'll call it sixth gen UAS, all those as very complementary to F-35. When you look at some of the missions and the capabilities, we see F-35 as having a critical role. but there is going to be a need for other platforms. So we're excited to continue to advance the capability of F-35, but we also, as a Lockheed Martin Corporation, are very engaged and look forward to participating in some of the next-gen capabilities.
But when it comes to the rate and that balance, right? I mean, you guys are playing in this entire sphere, and depending on how these competitions go, clearly you guys could have a role in either all of these programs or some of them, or, you know, perhaps not. But, right, you guys have got a pretty good win rate when it comes to this stuff. Can you easily stretch this production at a lower rate without unsteadying the cost gains you've made, I guess is one of my questions, right? So if you reduce the rate and say, look, I'm going to buy fewer airplanes, but maybe at a lower rate to free resources to go someplace else, can you end up, you know, is the program stable enough in terms of cost reduction for you to be able to make that? Or is that something that you would potentially unsteady in trying to achieve these other goals as well?
So we would have to continue to work that with the JPO and the services as well as the partners. You know, obviously there's a quantity sensitivity to anything you procure on the defense side. But again, if you look at how do you get capacity, there's nothing that, I mean, we're delivering, you know, we were on track to deliver 141 jets this year. We delivered 121 last year. There is no other way to get capacity quickly at a you know, very competitive price when you look at the fact that we can deliver, you know, upwards of, you know, we were on track to deliver 160 some jets next year. There is no way to get that kind of capacity that quickly with a, you know, an $80 million or less jet. So again, we actually think with the threats that are out there globally, developing next gen aircraft, they're not going to be available operationally anytime soon. So, you know, we're absolutely committed to continue to drive capabilities of the F-35 in the interim until you can get to the, you know, the next gen aircraft, or as Dr. Roper talks about, the Digital Century series.
Right. How do you develop programs faster, right? I mean, the F-35, I covered it since its inception. You know, it was Joint Strike Fighter. In all elements of the program since the early 1990s. And here we are, we're still not at full operational capability. During the Cold War, we were developing that kind of capability, whether the F-117 or even productionized aircraft like the F-14 in about 5 years. I know General C.Q. Brown, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, is talking about, you know, making this, you know, a much bigger focus to field a lot of capability more quickly. What are the keys to be able to deliver capability more quickly, whether it's NGAD, whether it's FXX, whether it's any other program, given that there is this greater recognition that the urgency, that the speed to fielding things is actually a strategic discriminator?
You know, you think about where technology has moved since, you know, the F-35 contract award, which, you know, you think about that, that was back probably right about the time, or maybe even before mobile phones, you know, were available. So technology has moved tremendously. And again, I mentioned quickly about the digital transformation that we're undergoing in Lockheed Martin. And that really spans every aspect of a program, from engineering, using model-based systems engineering, kind of a, I'll call it factory of the future capabilities. You're not going to build all the infrastructure that you have on a production line like an F-16. So again, a much more advanced production facility. And then even into sustainment, as you think about AI, data analytics, and some of the things that we've been able to do with supply chain. So really, every aspect of a program is going through kind of, you know, the digital transformation and being able to bring next-gen technologies that really are going to advance. If you look at what we're doing from an engineering perspective, you know, with some of the model-based systems engineering, just it is amazing what that will do in terms of, you're going to be doing a lot of your manufacturing engineering while you're doing your design engineering. So it's really going to be able to compress that whole engineering timeline. And again, it's not just in Lockheed Martin. We're doing it in partnership with our suppliers. So you're going to get that benefit all the way down the supply chain. And that's what's really going to speed up programs and get you to delivering capabilities much faster than, I would say, legacy platforms. So it's a really exciting time. For us, it's a competitive advantage in terms of, you know, hiring talent. When we go to universities, you know, engineers want to work on, you know, manufacturing engineers, design engineers, they want to work on modern next gen tools and capabilities. So for us, it's been great as we've continued to hire, even through COVID, to really position ourselves for the future and be the partner to the services as they think about next gen needs.
You mentioned Dr. Roper's digital century series and digital threads, obviously being something that's very, very important to try to get that foot speed faster. And also Dr. Roper's concept that, hey, you know, we don't have to make big bangs. We can make actually smaller bangs. And given changes in manufacturing technology and standardization and a whole bunch of other things, we should be able to get actually tailored blocks of aircraft made, something which Lockheed Martin has over the many decades proven very, very adept at, you know, F-117, again, being an example, but there are many others. Talk to us a little bit about your Star Drive initiative and how you see yourself taking advantage of these cycles, right? I mean, you mentioned that you guys have an advantage. Talk to us about Star Drive and how it feeds into this larger speed strategy.
Yes. So Star Drive was really our initiative to support the digital transformation and the Digital Century series. So it was our opportunity to really look at how do we transition our business quickly. It started with a brand new program because again, you know, end to end, it's great on a brand new program. But I'll also share with you, we're now taking advantage of Star Drive, and a lot of what we're doing is really going to even benefit F-35 in production. You know, while many elements of the F-35 design won't change, there's still going to be mission systems upgrades. So we're going to take advantage of it there, as well as in production for F-35. Part of how we got to an $80 million jet, we're going to continue to drive the price down, is leveraging that digital transformation. So Star Drive really, you know, as you tune in, hopefully next week, we'll give you a briefing on Star Drive. You'll really get to see how we're accelerating that transition to the digital environment. And it's not just even from a design and a manufacturing perspective, even from a software perspective. You hear a lot of talk about how do we get to kind of a containerized environment where software is containerized. You hear technologies like Kubernetes that we're investing in across all of our platforms, including even F-22. So it really is going to be our way of accelerating our transition. And so we're excited about what Star Drive has really done for our aeronautics business.
Let me ask you about you and I talked in Paris a little bit about lessons learned that could be applied to future combat aircraft and how a lot of F-35 DNA may actually end up in there. As new programs are launched, what are the lessons learned from the F-35? I mean, I know that there are myriad of lessons, but in your mind, is there any refinement to those lessons that can be applied to newer combat aircraft programs, whether they're manned or optionally manned programs, or even completely unmanned systems that can be derived so far from F-35?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, we're even taking some of the lessons learned and pouring it back into F-35 and even an F-16. So there are many lessons learned. Some of them, as we mentioned, are kind of the process and the tools that we use within Lockheed Martin. And some of it is, you know, advancing technology. I'll just give you an example. If you look at lethality and survivability, you know, you mentioned F-117. And what we did in terms of being able to leverage that into F-22, and then we leveraged F-22 into F-35. And that'll also be what we leverage into next gen, whether it's, you know, a manned or unmanned platform. So you're absolutely right. We're going to continue to leverage lessons learned, but also advance technology, take advantage of not only the technology on the platforms, but the technologies we use to develop, manufacture, and sustain platforms. So again, I think the pace of technology is going to continue to speed up, and we're going to be able to take advantage of that and not only bring forward, you know, the lessons learned, but also take advantage of technology advancements.
Is an unmanned F-35 going to be something that we're going to see
sooner rather than later. I mean, I remember being at the press conference with General Fogelman when he was talking about the F-35 and saying, look, he kind of expected later blocks to be unmanned. Is that something, I know you get asked that question periodically, but is that something that's a reasonable expectation, or is that sort of dubious and that you would want different characteristics if you were going to develop an unmanned combat system?
We're always going to be looking at that. I don't think it's unreasonable. I think you could go at some point look at an unmanned F-35. But I also think, you know, depending on the mission, you're going to tailor platforms, whether it's manned or unmanned, to the mission. So again, I think we'll leverage all the capabilities of Lockheed Martin depending on the mission.
You're very generous with your time. Let me ask you two quick questions. I have to ask you about the F-16, and we'll make that the last question. But let me ask you a volume development question, right? We historically, as the United States, have shot for a higher degree of capability. F-35 is extraordinary because of the amount of capability that's stuffed into that platform for the kind of price that you're trying to get to. Obviously, volume is key to doing it. But if you look at it, whether it's on hypersonics or unmanned systems, there are theoreticians who say actually the trick is to get a lot of capability for extremely low cost. There are folks who are talking about that on the interceptor side of it. I know that your missiles and fire control folks are looking at it, how to do volume precision strike, but also volume air defense, but do it for a lot less money. What do you think the keys are to get that individual sophistication, but then drive the cost down to the point where we have, you know, the United States and its allies have the volume advantage as opposed to adversaries?
I would say the foundation to that is a partnership with our customers, that we have tight alignment in terms of the mission, the requirements. And so when we get to leveraging some of the engineering, manufacturing, and sustainment tools, we're able to do it at speed. And we deliver a product that's, you know, what they need and more so. So I think the foundation of that is a partnership with our services and our customers, to really partner to drive speed and make sure that we understand the mission, the requirements, so that we're able to leverage technology.
Let me ask you a last question, which is on F-16. Extraordinary program. If I had gotten a dollar each time people were erecting a tombstone on it, I'd probably be a wealthy man. There were some people even in Lockheed who were suggesting that a tombstone be erected on the program, and now it looks like it's got an entirely new lease on life. What's the road ahead on F-16, and where is its role in the Lockheed Martin portfolio, especially for customers that may not want an F-35, but want a very, very good fourth generation, or even with some capability improvements, a 4-plus generation combat aircraft?
So we are really excited about where the F-16 is and the potential that it continues to see, globally. As you know, we stood up a production facility in Greenville. And so we're excited. Bahrain, Bulgaria, Slovakia were the first orders. And you probably recently saw the IDIQ contract that we signed with the Air Force for Taiwan and Morocco, really looking at our Block 70 baseline aircraft for those countries. And we do see opportunities. And from a Lockheed Martin perspective, I think you hit the point of there are countries that aren't quite ready for the F-35. And so we're excited to work with them to, you know, get them an F-16 and then help them. You know, over the years, we view the F-16 as the path to F-35 for many of these countries. So again, we're excited about the potential and the opportunities to continue. We've delivered 4,600 F-16s, and we certainly would be excited to get closer to 5,000 of those by the time the program's over. So again, it's got a great life ahead of it. And we're excited to see the opportunities ahead of it.
Do you think that Germany could be one of those buyers? I mean, obviously, there's this concern, or at least the German government has sort of suggested it did not want F-35s, but there's been some talk about F-18s. If the F-18 can be in that competition, can an F-16 Block 70 be a contender? Both there or for the Canadians or any one of a number of other customers?
So as you know, Canada is in the source selection, and the F-35 is the platform that we submitted as our offering. Back to Germany, though, we would be glad to offer the F-16 or the F-35 to Germany. So we'd love to see Germany consider either of those platforms. But for the F-35, again, we see tremendous opportunities there in Canada, Switzerland, Finland. So again, we're very fortunate that we see tremendous opportunities for both the F-16 and F-35.
And do you have an F-16 number in mind about how many more you think you're going to build?
I don't have a number. I mentioned our stretch goal would be 5,000. But again, we're going to continue to offer it as long as customers are interested and it meets their needs and capabilities. And for countries, we're excited to have them procure the F-16 on the path to potentially later procuring the F-35.
Michelle, thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Take care.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.